Welcome to the Dementia Research Project. I'm Matt DeRay, and in this podcast, I explore the history, innovation, and champions in and around the world of dementia. Today's guest is Professor Chris Fox, a psychiatrist and internationally recognized expert in aging, dementia care, and health services research. He's a professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Exeter and co-leads the Splendid Project, one of the UK's largest studies exploring how social prescribing can support people living with dementia. Thank you very much for your time, Professor. How are you?
I'm fine, Matthew, and it's great to be on this podcast.
Thank you very much. Diving straight into the Splendid Project, Professor, that's how I came to learn about you and the great work you're doing. If you don't mind just sharing a bit about what is Splendid and what problems does it address and why is it significant now?
Splendid was developed because of the issues that people with dementia and their families have with social prescribing, because social prescribing is for multiple different disorders, and our plan was to try and bespoke it, tailor it to the needs of families and patients with dementia so that they could basically work with it better, because not all activities in social prescribing are appropriate. So the whole point of Splendid was to co-design a pathway. Not necessarily worrying about the activities, because there are probably hundreds and hundreds of different activities, from stroking llamas, walking with owls, going into sheds, swimming, surfing. I could go on and on and on, couldn't I? But what we wanted to do is to improve the engagement activity, which involves a link worker. So our project will develop skills that the link worker can use to help tailor the offering or the prescription all summer with dementia and their family members, because we've had a lot of pushback that family members want to take part. So we're open to that, although our primary focus is the person with dementia. And this is dementia at any stage, apart from end of life, of course.
And just to give a sense of size and scale and also geography, which part or what are the pilot sites and how many people are currently involved? And what are the timelines of the study right now, Professor?
So we've spent the first 2 years developing, understanding the pathway. So we've undertaken some UK national engagement activities with interviewing people taking part in social prescribing, both from the staff and the patient perspective, as well as meaningful outcomes. So what is an important outcome to measure to show that social prescribing is working? So we are about to start at the end of this year, the feasibility trial. So at the moment, we're in setup. So we've got what the pathway designed, we've got what we want, and now we're developing a protocol to then test it with about 6 regions in the UK. These will be based some south, some north, but we're very interested in diversity, including ethnicity. So we're particularly going to sites with a high sort of South Asian, Indian and Bangladeshi region, because they're important as a voice to understand their particular perspectives. And we know there are particular religious connotations. For example, there's issues of trust in certain religions, such as Muslims, and often they look at these things through the imam. So therefore, we're particularly thinking about how the pathway could integrate into those particular religious groups and other religious groups. And that's been hard work. So we're actually slightly behind because it's taken so much time, but we are now ready for that. Feasibility, I said, is going to be 5 to 6 sites, perhaps about 60, 70 people, and we'll get feedback during that. And then after that, we go to a huge study, about 600 people, up to about 100 sites in the UK, and that'll be the full definitive. Then from that, we will have what needs to be put in a pathway for delivering social prescribing, and that potentially could move anywhere. So, okay, it could be NHS specific, with link workers, etc. But a lot of this can transfer into other countries, because the core part of social prescribing is developing the prescription and having a link worker to do that, which is someone you sit down with, have a chat, and they tailor that to your needs. And that could be done in Malaysia, Hong Kong, wherever, US or Canada. And it's a growing movement, of course. But this study, Splendid, is the biggest dementia one, probably in the whole world, but certainly in the UK. We've got a budget of about £3 million for the whole program, which is huge.
That's fantastic. And you mentioned the design phase of this project. when something is so big, like it's almost systemic, how do you maintain that person-centeredness? Because the question I'm leading to here is essentially, what are the components for this social prescribing program, and how dynamic is it for each individual?
I think it's about engagement. So you have to talk to people with dementia and their families, and also talk to the staff delivering. Some of the staff we've spoken to, for example, have said that they were firefighting in primary care. What that means is the GPs are so busy, they were picking up some of the work in dementia. So that was an interesting insight. They shouldn't be doing that. It's more so we're putting that into the training. And if that happens, they need to learn to push back. The other thing that we've learned about is that they're desperate for training the link workers. What you said. How can I engage? What are the specific nuances? So we're developing a package of training which will support that communication. And that's important, because sending someone, you know, 10 miles to a park or a zoo, A, costs money, and B, they may not want to travel for whatever reason. So you've got to think about the geography. And in some cities in the UK, there is little green space. So what can we do for them that involves little costs, or potentially if you want to pay, you can. That's another issue though, co-payments. I'm not going to go there. What we're offering at the moment is something that is free at the point of service. So our offering on the pathway will be, I like outside activities, good. And then the link worker will know in their, they're like a navigator. They'll know locally what is available. Because not everywhere has got a beach. Not everywhere has got green space. Not everywhere has got art galleries. So they have to be, the link worker is like the eyes and ears on the ground. You know, you don't want to travel. You want, what is in my back area? What is in my locality? And the thing about social prescribing is it's quite broad, because it has blue prescribing, which is anything to do with the sea. It can be beaches as well. Green is nature. And then there are other forms as well that are developing, such as more sort of do-it-yourself, dancing, appreciation of art, stargazing, etc. Those are a bit more, yeah, but the blue and the green are very interesting, because that gets you physical activity as well, which we know has a benefit for people with dementia, getting people active, and also the social aspect. The core part of this is improving the socialization, trying to help loneliness, which is a key factor in progression of dementia, but also preventing dementia. And there is a plan that we may well consider this as a strategy to stop dementia coming on so early. But at the moment, we're waiting to see if this works. But imagine the situation, Matthew, where you're a bit tired, you've got some minor memory problems, but you haven't got dementia. Potentially, social prescribing could be something that could maintain your brain quite easily. I mean, that would be quite attractive. And that's where the carers come in, because often they've got memory problems because they're tired caring for their loved ones.
That's fantastic. So it looks beyond the at-risk groups, but even to the people who may be at some point, like caregivers are a prime example.
And with these new drugs, Matthew, which are not available in our country, but you can imagine this as an add-on, because the new drugs at the moment are not a cure. All the drug companies say that. It's to slow the illness down. It does not reverse it. And therefore, you know, they accept there should be some added non-drug intervention. The social prescribing could fit that quite nicely, beyond just forcing people to eat strange food. Doing something alongside having an infusion might well keep it further at bay than it is. And there is interest, I know, amongst the research community in that.
What are some of the early lessons in terms of enablers or barriers? You mentioned one very interesting cultural one around the religious aspect, but are there anything else that comes to mind?
I think that there is also the issue of tailoring, because you have to understand someone's perspective. If I said to you, for example, okay, why don't you go to a gallery? Well, you might not want to go to a gallery. And the other thing we've noticed is some people don't want to go to a group thing. They don't mind going to one-on-one, and you can do social prescribing on your own. You can prescribe something for you without doing anything. So it's being aware of that, because people will not turn up. If you say you're going to go farming as a dementia farm activity, I don't like cows and I don't like other people in large crowds. So it's not going to work, is it? So it's that understanding, which is key for the link worker to understand themselves, and also having time. And the other key learning we've got is trying not to get overloaded with non call social prescribing activities, i.e. they become surrogate nurses, you know, arranging blood tests, arranging people to go to hospital, when it should be that's in clinical care, the medical side. And this is, you know, this is not about drugs, this is about non-drug treatment. And that, and certainly in the pandemic and still around a little bit, they have become a bit of a, well, let's put them there because maybe they can plug this problem we've got with supporting these people. So it's saying no, it's not appropriate.
Which leads me very nicely into the next question. What role do non-clinical professionals play in this? So people like, you mentioned link workers, yeah, cultural workers, artists, people who are maybe not considered part of the health system, right? What role can they play proactively?
They can proactively be involved because they are the provider arm to an extent. They are the coordinators of all these activities. The people who take people on walks, or as you say, the artists or the dance people, they're non-clinical. So they can offer something. And there is a growing offering, and often the offerings are provided by charities. So that's the other thing. There are some private providers, but also mainly it's charity provision. It's about community bits as well, Matthew, and people are prepared to pay. That's the other thing. So we've looked and people pay, you know, £5, because obviously there's power, lighting, insurance, some of these activities. So not everything is free. And there is a broad spectrum of offerings. That's what I would say. It's fascinating. And some people are prepared to pay quite a bit. But the ability to pay, Matthew, one of my bugbears is, shouldn't be a barrier to someone not getting something. So if I offered you, you know, go to a wonderful holiday resort somewhere in a beach and you can have all this private tuition and driving a speedboat, that's not going to happen, is it? So you shouldn't be offering necessarily that, because that will create problems, because they'll feel stigmatized and say, well, hang on a minute, that's not the real world. So it's that balance. But there is an acceptance of the community, they have to contribute something, because obviously, you know, buildings cost, as I said, travel, transport, etc. So it's thinking about the costs of activity, because these things have to be sustained. And if you've got your artisan artist who's offering lovely art classes, if they're not getting their costs covered, it's going to finish in a week, isn't it? So we're thinking the business model, and we're looking at that with our health economic evaluation in Splendid. It's so-called a discrete choice experiment, where we say to people, what is your willingness to pay? And that's another core part. If you were offered this, would you be prepared, if this benefit happened, to do that, both in time and money, potentially? But it's not extreme cost.
And this question, has it been already posed? And is there some initial answers on that?
Well, that will be coming out of the feasibility and then the main trial. So what we designed the interrogation questionnaire, which is the discrete choice experiment, and then we will put that to people, and then we'll know the answers definitively.
As part of my research, I understand there's a tech component to this as well. Could you speak to that? And I guess because there's so different stakeholders at play, how do you think about the feedback loop and how tech actually helps streamline some of these feedback loops and communication?
I mean, the idea behind the tech, and it has changed because we got a strong sense from link workers and from people with dementia, they don't like using apps. Some do, but most don't. So how we envisaged it, and I think as society changes, people will be more tech interested. But the advantage of tech is it can provide you with more choice, potentially with artificial intelligence. It also gives you a way of recording things so that you know you've discussed these things and you can look on your phone, like you're booking an air ticket, where am I going, what class do I want, what time of flight, etc. So that's useful. And the key reason we put tech in was to try and get a way to communicate with the clinical side. So one of the problems has been the record keeping. How does this thing that is non-medical get into the medical? Because it needs to, so the GP is aware, and then it can also perhaps extract data so it knows that people who are in a wheelchair aren't going to want to go dancing, hypothetically, that intelligence aspect. But we did hit a sort of lot of forceful no app. So we are going to perhaps offer an app which exists. It's already been developed by an organization, and they claim that it can act as a memory aid as such, but we're primarily interested in human factors. But in the future, I think it will be more techy. At the moment, we're just trying to get the staffing aspect and the choice. I don't think the human, well, it hopefully won't be replaced in this, because it does need that human factors aspect. That's our view.
What aspect of the what you're doing with Splendid do you think is very much transferable to low resource settings? It sounds like actually a lot can be applied universally.
The primary thing that I think could be of benefit anywhere in the world is the skill set and what the link worker or the navigator or whatever you call it have different names. But that'll be a key learning, and that can go anywhere. And it says key features that you need to consider in your assessment when you're coming up with the prescription, which is basically a plan, isn't it? And that could be in Malaysia, it could be in Bangladesh, whatever. And we're well aware of the issues of those, but the staff issues are very similar, I'm sure.
Are there particular partnerships you feel are extremely critical to getting something like this off the ground, whether it's regulatory, funding, even at the community level?
I think that the critical thing, if I was developing this from scratch, would be having the local charities involved and also engaging with relevant parts of government, health ministry, etc., to sort of settle the message that this could reduce costs and is relatively cheap, side effect free, and can be done anywhere in the world. You don't need an American drug or a British drug. You could do it on your back street. It's almost like reinventing a wheel. A wheel is a wheel, and it's the same in Malaysia as it's the same in the UK. There's nothing special, but it's the key strands of it that are important. So that's the beauty of social prescribing. It can be any place, any time, anywhere. The content is up to you, what you've got in your locality.
And so you mentioned right now you're heading into the new stage around feasibility. Are there any challenges you expect once you operationalize? Or what are some of the things like on your horizon you think, okay, this is something we need to work around?
I think there are some with language. We've already hit a few issues with the word prescription because it has connotations. It normally means a drug. And then it's the word social. And we're not going to reinvent the word social prescribing, but I think it's the way you talk about these things. It's you have to have that, you know, it's got to stimulate you, help with your fitness, potentially introduce you to new skills. Otherwise, they'll say, what's all this about? And before you can get to first base, they say, I don't want a prescription, don't like medication, or I want medication, I don't want this. So that's a key thing. And that's issue of recruitment. So we need to recruit people to take part to actually do the experiment. And that's always a problem, isn't it? So it's getting that message right and the key support materials. So we're going to use a lot of social media, you know, right, a lot of imagery, some videos, podcasts to try and have it so that people are aware of what they're letting themselves in for and they don't feel it's alien. Because it is not the traditional model, social prescribing. It's not go to a doctor, get therapy, or go to a doctor and get a drug. It's go to a doctor and who then sends you to a link worker or goes direct to a link worker who's going to give you some activities that are relevant to social well-being that you could sort of find benefit. I mean, that's the other problem with social prescribing coming back. We say it works, but if you look at the evidence for it working, the trials are not, shall we say, optimal. So that's why we've developed Splendid. If you look at cancer and everything else, there's a lot of secondary data and small studies, but the large knockout trial shows this is superior. It's difficult to do and hasn't really been done. So a lot of the evidence for efficacy has come from cohorts, longitudinal, small bits of work. So this, if it works, will be probably the largest trial ever in any form of social prescribing. So if we show a signal there, then it can potentially move via a sort of flagship for designing evaluations anywhere in social prescribing. Because people who pay for this thing, if social prescribing does have a core cost for the link worker, they say in the UK, what's the return on investment? I give you £1 for a link worker, I want more than £1 back. And that, you know, there's a lot of, well, it looks like it's £10 back or £5 back, but it's not really been done in a randomized controlled trial. So if this is positive and we can show some economic benefit, then that will help expand the field further around the world. Because a lot of people, you know, they want to see that value. But in this is the government commissioners, whatever, health providers. And we're working quite closely with charities, and charities may well be the way forward for this in the future, in the UK anyway.
Just out of curiosity, have you reached out, or have wearables companies reached out to you? Because I'm thinking, especially around the whole health and longitudinal and data collection side of things, that's something I see.
Well, there is a well-known provider. I'm not going to get into brands, but it's based in Switzerland, that we kind of link to in other areas. And you can see that. And that is some of the companies that are looking at wearables, general sports watches, etc., are looking at that wellness measure to see if they can sell their product, which shows someone like you and me, you're well, forget the dementia and other bit. And you can see how that with sleep and activity could be helpful.
Final question, Professor. What are you hopeful for this project?
I hope that we'll be able to basically show benefit for patients as a result of the trial, which is cost effective, and also a legacy of improving staff or link worker skill set so that they are more open to working with people with dementia. Great. And if anyone wants to reach out, I am involved in studies elsewhere in 12 countries, for example, with preventing mental health and digital apps in different arena, including Ethiopia, Somalia, and the whole of European Union. So we are very collaborative.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Professor. It's been great.
Great. Great to see you.
Thanks for listening. If you want more of these type of stories, interviews, and guests, please follow the Dementia Research Project wherever you get your podcasts. Onwards and upwards.